hope that you can hear me. What I have to say must go on record somewhere before it is lost forever. I am Professor Wilbur Matlock, and my intention is to record my thoughts and feelings onto these tapes, to document them as fully as I am able, so that in the event of my death or a cover-up by forces unknown, at least something of what I have learned may survive. The stories you are about to hear are improbable. You may even find them ridiculous. But please believe me when I tell you that they are all true.
Professor Wilbur Matlock, born on the 13th of July 1921, studied medicine and psychiatry at the University of Oxford, but was defined by his private studies into what he referred to as the extraordinary, mad science, bad science, and even encounters with supernatural and alien creatures. The professor was studious about keeping records of his experiences. Presented here is just one of his taped recollections dating from October 1971. Other than some cleanup of the audio, the tapes are entirely unedited and remain exactly as they were when they were recorded in the 1970s. But please be aware that the audio quality may vary due to the age and the condition of the recordings. We have chosen to add music and sound effects in some places, and occasionally narration from supporting documentation and information collected from contemporary media has been inserted. Despite the professor's claim that his experiences are all true, we can make no guarantees that the events recounted on these tapes actually occurred as described. That is for you to decide. The Matlock Tapes. The Beast from Space.
An English public house on the edge of the coastal village of Breen in Somerset, England. 10:30 p.m. 6 October 1971. The bar should have been closed already, but the landlord and lady of the establishment had kept the beer flowing. It was a busy night, and their registers were ringing repeatedly, the happy crowd freely parting with their money for a quick libation. Mick and Angie Agnew, a newly married couple, sat next to each other nursing their drinks. Truth be told, they had been arguing. Mick had recently started to earn enough money to afford a motorcycle, and the sudden thrill of freedom it had bought was turning his mind to the idea that his wife and he should move away, perhaps to the big city. Angie resisted any attempt to broach the conversation, however. Her family lived in Breen, and she was not agreeable to the idea of being far from her dear old mum and dad. Mick was about to try once more to convince her when the door of the public house was thrown open. A new customer had arrived. But this was no local thirsty for a pint. The man was clad head to foot in a torn white spacesuit, his helmet still on but the visor cracked. He was sweating profusely and barely able to catch a breath. "Do you have a phone?" he croaked in an American accent. "I need to use your phone." A strange kind of hush descended upon the pub as the drinkers watched the new arrival in bafflement. Was this some kind of joke? It was a little early for dressing up for Halloween. The landlord couldn't be sure that this wasn't some trick being played on him, but he smiled and went along with it. "Who would you be calling at this time of night, then?" he asked. "Mission Control, Houston," the ragged astronaut replied, dripping water onto the bar. "Local calls only, pal," the landlord answered prosaically. The man became aware of the attention that would focus upon him, and he suddenly felt terribly afraid. The fear response triggered another of anger, and he swore loudly, thumped the bar with his gauntleted fist, and stormed off out of the pub as fast as his unstable legs would carry him. "Well, you don't see that sort of thing every day," the landlord joked, breaking the awkward silence. Most of the clientele of the establishment returned to their noisy conversations, all apart from Mick and Angie. "What was all that about?" Mick scratched his goatee beard. "Perhaps you'd better get after him," Angie suggested, her face a picture of concern. "He looked hurt." "Oh, come on, Ange, she could have gone anywhere," He's probably heading for the phone box down the end of the lane. Go on, she ordered. Go and see if he's all right. Mick knew when arguing with her was pointless, so stood up, downed the last dregs of his pint, and sighed. All right, Angie dear.
A newspaper article from the Western Chronicle, 7th of October, 1971. Splashdown. Reports of a falling star flooded into the news desk yesterday evening, but we are pleased to confirm that aliens have not landed in Breendown. A funnel-shaped capsule tumbled from the skies on Wednesday at around 9:45 p.m. before splashing down a few hundred feet out to sea. The spaceship was entirely of earthly origin, having been sent up on Tuesday morning by NASA Space Control in Houston, Texas. We understand that a fault developed after liftoff, leading to the craft spinning into a decaying orbit that eventually led it to our shores. The pilot, Major Doug Utterson, was not found among the wreckage, and a search for his body continues. Police say that talk of his unexpected arrival in full spacesuit at a local pub are, quote, stuff and nonsense.
Mick turned up the collar of his jacket. It was cold outside. His eyes adjusted to the gloom, helped somewhat by the clouds covering the moon blowing aside and letting its illumination light at least some of the wet country village. He walked in the direction of the village phone box. The welcoming noise and thump of music emanated from the pub, dying slowly as he moved further away. He shivered, not due to the cold this time, but due to that sudden onset of a prickly kind of fear. Something felt wrong. That was the only way he could describe it. It did not help that he was all alone out there. He kept within the sickly light of the street lamps. He neared the phone box, squinting to see if the moving shape he could just make out inside was the incongruous astronaut. It was hard to tell in the moonlight. Hello? He shouted, the quiver in his voice betraying his strange fear. Then he stopped walking. Whatever that was in the phone box certainly wasn't human, and it was leaving the booth and heading towards him, fast. He turned to run from whatever the creature that was gaining on him was, sheer terror propelling his legs as fast as they would go. The creature was faster than he was, and when it caught up with him, it split open its salivating jaws and tore right through Mick Agnew's throat. Good God, was my first reaction to the sight of the body lying in the mortuary. Whatever had attacked this man had done so with such ferocity that poor Mick Agnew's head was virtually detached from his body. This is all I need, Inspector George Moore mumbled from behind his cigarette. Can you see now why I called you out here? Indeed I could. I had worked with Inspector Moore several times now, he being one of the few officers of Her Majesty's Constabulary that did not regard me to be some kind of charlatan or dangerous lunatic. And you say that his wife disturbed the creature and it ran off into the shadows? George nodded, flicking ash onto the corpse, which I carefully removed with a handkerchief. His wife is quite distraught, he understated. I've no doubt she is, but could she really give no more of a description other than a large, hairy creature dressed in white? The inspector nodded. That's all we could get out of her. I trusted that she was receiving the care she needed and dismissed the idea of asking her any further questions. The coroner's report into this bite is very interesting, I said, examining the hastily typed file. The bite pattern is that of a large dog, yet the indentations left by the teeth reveal themselves to be, well, I can scarcely believe I'm saying this, but they're the teeth of a human being. This is all I need, he said again, clearly more concerned about his workload than the poor victim lying before us. What with that missing astronaut as well? Let me tell you, the bloody Yanks are breathing down my neck about him. You still haven't found him yet, then? I asked while giving most of my attention to the report. Amazing that he had survived the burn-up of re-entry. The news of the accidental crash of an American space capsule was now common knowledge across England. The fire brigade had recovered the wreckage of the ship from the sea, but the pilot was missing. It seemed too unlikely that, firstly, an astronaut would walk into a pub. That sounds like a joke. An astronaut would walk into a pub, and then a strange creature would appear in the vicinity just afterwards. It was too unlikely for the two events to be unconnected. Had Major Doug Utterson, for that was the name of the spaceman, somehow brought the monster back from space with him? I kept such thoughts to myself. It would do no good to share them with the inspector. A squawk from George's radio made us both jump. He took the walkie-talkie from his jacket pocket and held it close to his mouth. "Is that you, John?" he spoke into it. A few seconds later, his colleague John came on the line. "I think you'd better head to the beach, sir," John suggested. "What is it?" George snapped back at him. "There's been another murder, sir." The victim was a middle-aged man, a vagrant by the looks of his clothes, discovered in the sand dunes. The human body contains a fantastic amount of blood, and most of his was soaked in the sand around him. The flies were enjoying themselves, if no one else was. "How long has he been here?" I asked the young medical officer examining his body. "Since last night," the young chap answered. "I can tell from how the blood has dried on his face. Can you see it? At least 10 hours. "What are we going to do?" George asked me quietly. He was completely out of his depth here. "What could this monster want?" "You're looking for the missing astronaut, aren't you, George? Well, perhaps our monster is too." "Sir," the young officer called over to George. He strode towards us with something in his hand. "Found something interesting, sir, on the body." He held out his palm and showed us a small piece of torn white material. "What is it, Billy?" George asked him. It had a strange, almost transparent quality on its surface.
"Don't know, sir."
"I do," I told him.
"Where exactly did you find this, sir? Billy, wasn't it?" "Near the victim's left hand, Professor. Almost as though he'd torn it off his attacker."
I looked out to sea. "The space capsule only had one pilot, correct?"
"I don't see what that has to do with this, but yes."
"That confirms it, then."
George lost his temper.
"Confirms what, exactly?"
I turned to him.
"Well, it's good news for you, at least, Inspector. You thought you had two jobs here in Breen. It turns out you've only got one."
Young Billy was catching on.
"Oh, I think I understand."
"You're the bloody only one," was George's considered response.
"That fabric is called Tablon," I said. "It's very new and manufactured only in the United States, used on the outer surface of spacesuits."
"That's right, Inspector. The missing astronaut and the mystery killer are both one and the same."
The following audio recording was released from the United States National Archive of Radio Communications after a Freedom of Information request in 1997. The recording dates back to October 1971. The authorities insist that this is not a genuine capture of NASA communications, but a hoax created by two CB radio enthusiasts in Arizona. They deny this accusation.
"Course check, Doug. Are you reading me?"
"Reading okay, Control. It looks like I'm a degree or two up course."
"We're seeing a variance of 3 degrees down here."
"Shall I make a correction to starboard?"
"Hang on, Doug. We'll check it out." "Yes, go ahead, Doug. 3 degrees starboard."
"That look any better now, Control?"
"Sure does. Say, we've got a visitor here who would like to talk to you." "Here, General. Take the mic."
"Hello, son. Can you hear me?"
"Loud and clear, General."
"What's it look like up there?"
"Oh, beautiful. Just beautiful."
"That new plexiglass holding out?"
"Well, I'm talking with you, ain't I? I sure wish you could see this, sir. The moon is so big and so bright out here. I can see it so clearly."
"Get a good look, son. Enjoy yourself."
"The pressure is raising, Doug."
"Can you repeat?"
"We're monitoring a huge leap in your blood pressure, Doug. What's got you all excited up there?"
"The moon. I can't stop looking at it. I just can't stop.
What's wrong, son?
Doug, are you with us? Oh, Doug, come in, please.
What's going on here?
Gotta take this suit off.
Don't take your suit off, Doug.
I picked it all over.
Doug, are you okay?
My face hurts. I'm
You're tearing it here.
What the hell's going
Doug.
On?
We've got him! We've got him! I had been sleeping peacefully, if uncomfortably, in the back of George's car when he woke me. I was dazed momentarily. It was now dark outside. I looked at my wristwatch. Goodness, 10 p.m. already. George helped me out, a broad grin on his face. We had a report from the house up on the clifftops. The lady there says she saw a man in a spacesuit acting suspiciously this afternoon. Reckons he stole some things from her. Then he disappeared into the caves below the house. We raced down to the beach and over to the caves, the lapping tide soaking our shoes. Have you called for backup, George? I asked him on the way. Bloody right I have. The Americans are sending some people too. They're only a few minutes away, apparently. Well, let's try and deal with this without escalating things, eh, Inspector? He didn't answer. We arrived at the cave mouth. George shone his torch inside, but it was too deep and dark to reveal anything. Doug Utterson, he called into the gaping mouth. Major Doug Utterson, are you in there? Come out, we've got you surrounded. We heard nothing but the roar of the waves for at least a minute, and then, I ain't coming out, an American voice, tired but defiant. Then we'll come in. George threw down his cigarette and took out his revolver. Stay right where you are, the astronaut shouted. I've got a hostage down here. George looked at me, his brow furrowed. Was this a bluff? That's right, sir. A thin, familiar voice came from the cave. Billy, is that you? I'm sorry, sir. He got me. I took command of the situation. Billy, can you tell me about Major Utterson's present condition? What do you mean? Is he entirely human? We waited for Utterson to give Billy permission to reply. I realized then that I'd never seen George so scared. He's angry, Professor. Very angry. But human? I asked. That creature, Utterson cried, upset at my line of questioning. That creature isn't me! Are you sure about that, Major? I asked. Can I come inside? I only want to talk to you. George shook his head disapprovingly, but I ignored him. He says it's okay, Billy answered on his behalf. I'll come out and you come in. I got a gun, Utterson warned. All right, Major, there's no need for violence. I'm coming inside. Out you come too, Billy. I entered the cave and took Billy's place as hostage. Utterson had clearly gone on a raid. He had a flickering gas lamp, some blankets, and some stolen food down there. He held a shotgun, also stolen, no doubt, right at me, point-blank range. The man was a mess. His Tavlon suit was torn in what must have been hundreds of places. His hair matted with sweat. He was angry. Billy was right about that. But it was an anger produced by fear. Hello, Major, I said calmly. Looks like you've been making a home for yourself down here. What else can I do? He replied sadly. I can't go back to Houston now, not if I'm... I completed the sentence. A werewolf, Major? Is that what you are? He nodded slowly, emotionally. But he was still sensible enough to cover me with a shotgun. Would you like to tell me what happened? I was up there in space. The moon was so bright and beautiful, and it seemed to be calling to me, whispering, the voice getting louder as I got closer. The proximity to the moonlight must have triggered something that lay latent within him, I surmised. I changed. I changed into an animal, and then I crashed down here, and sometimes I'm not that thing, and sometimes I am. I just can't control my rage. Do you understand me? I just have to act on it. I looked upon him sadly. Put the gun down, Major. Let's leave this place and get you some help, shall we? I'd misjudged him. He reacted savagely. I can't go back. I won't. I'll kill you if you make me. I'm an animal, a damn monster. I rubbed my chin thoughtfully. What if we could control the monster inside you, Major? Would you surrender yourself then? He shook his head, but the gun in his shaking hands was lowering. It's not possible. I can't go back. It would seem to me that episodes of your bestial nature only occur when you are in direct moonlight. All of your attacks have been at night, and not when you were inside, or when the clouds covered the moon. It was the exposure to direct moonlight that triggered this in you. What are you saying, old man? What I am saying is that... Look, why don't we cover you with these blankets, and I will lead you outside. As long as you are covered up at all times in the moonlight, well, the beast inside of you cannot assert itself. He put the gun down on the ground. What happens then? Straight to jail for me, right? Or worse than that, some kind of secret lab where old guys like you stick needles in me and... I risked a move closer to him, and upon seeing he did not react aggressively, I put a hand on his shoulder. Don't worry, Major Utterson. Doug, I will make sure that no one treats you badly. Please believe me. Some of the tension left his dirty face and a slight smile formed in its place. Okay. I believe you. We're coming out. Don't shoot. We're coming out peacefully. I led the Major, blanket over his head, slowly and carefully out of the cave and onto the beach. George and Billy were nowhere to be seen. In their place, six black-clad commandos, United States flags on their body armor. Six guns raised in my direction, barrels glinting in the moonlight. The Americans had arrived. Now, don't be hasty, gentlemen. I let go of the Major's arm and put my hands up. What's going on? Utterson said from behind the blanket, the fear having returned to his voice. Some of your countrymen have arrived. It rather seems like they've taken control of things. Utterson shook and started walking backwards. I'm not going back, he trembled. Not like this. I'm a monster. Blinded by the covering over his face, he stumbled on a rock and fell backwards, the blanket slipping off him and onto the sand. Don't shoot, I begged the gunmen. Whatever happens now, don't shoot. Immediately upon the first sliver of moonlight striking Utterson's exposed skin, a transformation occurred. Thick tufts of grey hair erupted from every part of his body. His skull cracked as his face extended outwards, his mouth becoming a long snout, and his eyes receded and parted and blackened into the cunning eyes of a wolf. The gunfire echoed across the beach. You didn't need to do that, I told the Americans quietly. They flew the body of Major Doug Utterson back to the States in a body bag within a body bag within a body bag. He hadn't wanted to go, but at least he returned home as himself, because at the moment of death he reverted back into his human form, all traces of the feral creature he had been simply melted away. The news media were told he had drowned on re-entry. Angie Agnew was written off as a lunatic for her claims of seeing a hairy creature kill her husband. George received a tidy sum of money from an unknown source and retired early, as did young Billy. Mick Agnew's death certificate was adjusted to show that a heart attack was the cause of death, and that poor vagrant on the beach was never identified, nor had any family or friends inquire after him. Despite a few stories in the local papers for a few days afterwards, the events of those days have since been forgotten about by everyone, it seems, but me. But I won't forget what happened. No, I won't forget.
Tonight's tale was just the first of many Matlock tapes. In fact, the professor made hundreds of recordings and his entire archive has now been made available. We would like to share them with you. If you'll listen, please help us keep the work of Professor Matlock alive. Like, comment, subscribe, and share this podcast. The Matlock Tapes, the the Beast from Space, was presented by Giles Cosgrove, musical themes by Mr. Brown. The writer and producer was James Baxter.